are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 25th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Associate Professor of Economic History at the Industrial Labor Relations School at Cornell University, Lewis Hyman, on temp, how American work, American business, and the American dream became temporary. Also on the program today, Kavanaugh claims virginhood as a defense against sexual assault. Meanwhile, Rod Rosenstein not fired, but meeting with Trump on Thursday. Coincidentally, the same day Kavanaugh is testifying. Meanwhile, Trump at the UN, a laugh riot. Avenatti has a third accuser as Mark Judge is hiding somewhere at the beach.
With Spider-Man comics, right?
Is that right?
That's what I heard.
Dallas police force, Dallas police fire the cop in the Botham Jean killing. And there's a split on how and when to renew the Violence Against Women Act, which sunsets this weekend. Coincidentally.
Oh,
very seasonal.
Yes. And lastly, Monsanto's Roundup kills honeybees. Whoops. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, I imagine you will notice that there is a slight difference in the way that I did that headline today. We did not have, for the first time in, you know, I guess there's been moments where we've had to do, you know, something on the fly. But in the first time in, I don't know, years, I have done the opening of the show without pressure drop there. Part of the reason, well, no, the only reason is because we were getting copyright strikes on YouTube for it. Now, I have an ASCAP license, you know, for audio, but not YouTube does not recognize that stuff. There's no way to sort of put that through on YouTube. And I should be clear, we're not in trouble. We just can't monetize the video. And it's not a huge amount of money, but every little bit counts. So I'm putting it out there. If you are a musician, I don't want to get like one that's like somebody does on their small, you know, MIDI recorder.
Need some quality here.
Yeah. But I need a knockoff version of that, of Pressure Drop. Now, I'm not gonna. There's some folks out there who do ska, I understand, and occasionally do a Friday.
This might be your moment.
But this could be the moment. This is, it'll lock you in. But and it doesn't. There doesn't even have to be vocals. And if you do like a cool version with just like bongos. I don't know why it sticks in my head, but
you want bongos? Be careful
really
what you
bongos,
request, now.
Buddy.
Is that would that be too much?
I don't. I'm down for whatever. I just it just needs that energy.
Yeah, it needs that energy. That's all. And so, in the meantime, we're going to figure out some type of fix. I just it feels so lonely to do the headlines without music.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
It's weird. It's definitely weird. Believe me, you can imagine how weird it is for me.
Yeah,
folks. Speaking about being naked up there. Donald Trump was at the United Nations, and I think we can all relate to the anxieties that come with addressing a crowd. And they do tell you, one of the things that they tell you, or maybe they never tell you this, but I saw it on the Brady Bunch, you're supposed to imagine the whole audience in their underwear. That way you don't get nervous because you're like, well, what's going to happen? They're going to laugh at me? I'll laugh right back at them because they're all in their underwear. Let's hope that the president of the United States had that in mind today as he addressed all of the world's leaders at the United Nations, and they started to laugh at him.
Today I stand before the United Nations General Assembly to share the extraordinary progress we've made. In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
Yep. They laughed at
we're
you.
We're all friends.
It's all great.
It's all
I
great.
Can't wait to bomb all of you. I'm going to bomb you all.
I'm going to be so angry. This is going to be like...
This is, I mean, I will say that his reaction, at least, was not as angry as that correspondence dinner where Barack Obama mocked him, and he decided, I know what I'll do. I will I'll ruin the country because of that. So I think maybe the rest of the world is safe, but...
But when you're at the UN, you can't just picture people in their underwear because they don't wear underwear in other places.
I mean...
It's different things. Just it's sumo outfits.
For a moment...
Panther skin.
Think about how often we have heard, in the context of American politics, the lines, we are the laughingstock of the world. The world is laughing at us.
It's
and we
happening.
Finally made it so that it was literally the case.
They're not going to be laughing at us anymore because they're going to get it all out of their system.
All right, everybody got it out of your system? It's fun. Okay. Now back to the speech.
Ruining the world to own the libs.
There you go. Hey, if you like stories you hear on our show, we think you'll like the Sierra Club's new storytelling podcast, The Land I Trust. Season 2 of The Land I Trust is out now, bringing you storytellers from across the Western U.S. who share their experience in harvesting, protecting, and living with the four natural elements, water, fire, wind, and air. The series has 14 tales of individuals across the western part of the country as they share their tales of climate change, clean energy, and everything in between. Each year, the Sierra Club visits a different region of the country for a new set of stories. Season 1, stories from the American South. They talk to musicians, families, farmers, climate refugees, helping to move the South from coal ash pollution to a brighter, cleaner future. You can listen to The Land I Trust at beyondcoal.org/stories or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. Check out season 2 of The Land I Trust today. Just to give you a little highlight, we'll play a little more sound, but there's the developments over the past 24 hours in the Kavanaugh story. Included his testifying in front of Fox News, which is, I have to say, I was shocked. A week ago, I was saying, you know, Ford, Blasey Ford could go on television and this is something that Kavanaugh can't do. He can't go on and address this stuff. And well, he did. He did it on Fox. It was pretty fascinating. We will talk more about that. He included the idea that he was a virgin, so presumably he wouldn't have been caught up in what... Now, you got to follow me here. Avenatti has said that he has a client who will speak to allegations that Mark Judge was involved with people who would get women drunk, girls drunk in high school, and then have multiple guys have sex with them. Now, we've said in the past, Avenatti, there's a little bit of hyperbole there. I couldn't sit down and tell you what he's been right and wrong on at this point, and what he hasn't delivered and what he's indicated, some of which I think, you know, mostly he's delivered what he's indicated to a large extent. But I will also say, and I'll talk about this later in the program too, that in the New Yorker, and I haven't seen anybody make this connection, in the New Yorker, there is a story buried deep in that piece where a former girlfriend of Mark Judge alludes to something just like that, that Mark Judge told her about when they were in college, about when he was in high school. So we will talk more about that. Kavanaugh claimed that he was a virgin, I think as a defense against that story, which I think is going to get larger. He also then went on to say that he never even knew Blasey Ford, which I think is going to be very problematic, because there are people who certainly must know that she knew him. I mean, she can't be making that up, right?
That seems incredibly far-fetched.
That seems far-fetched to me. We will discuss all of that, but those are the only steps forward in this story as of yet. Although, there's also been Kavanaugh's roommate came out with a statement talking about Brett Kavanaugh as being a guy who abused alcohol significantly enough that it changed his personality significantly. We will discuss that. Also, there was another story that came from the Times that looked at the yearbook of Kavanaugh, and he and about a dozen other students at that school had basically had some type of code words in there implying that they had all had some type of relationship with a woman who was unaware that she was the target of this meme, essentially. We will talk about that. The other thing that, a brief update, and there's really not much to update here. At the time of this program yesterday, Rod Rosenstein headed to the White House to discuss with Donald Trump, I don't know what. Nobody seems to know what. That decision on Rosenstein's status was punted to Thursday. We don't know what that means. I saw a video which suggested that John Kelly wanted it to be seen that he was shaking Rosenstein's hand. I don't know what that means other than to project that things are civil, that John Kelly has a good relationship with Rosenstein. Don't know beyond that what that means. But that's going to happen on Thursday, presumably the same day where we're going to hear testimony from Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh, assuming they both show up. So that's where we are. The only thing I would say about the Rosenstein thing, and we will talk about who may or may not take over from him, is I don't know if it was a trial balloon yesterday. They wanted to see what would happen if they floated the idea that they were going to fire this guy. But certainly in retrospect, they can get a notion. And I didn't see anybody lighting their hair on fire about this. I'm talking about Republican senators. And so that's a little, gives you a little sense of where this might be headed. I should also say, somebody corrected me yesterday. I referred to Rosenstein as the acting attorney general. He is not the acting attorney general. He is acting as the attorney general in the context of the Mueller investigation, because the attorney general has recused himself. He is, in fact, the deputy attorney general. So that's that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Lewis Hyman, Associate Professor of Economic History at the Industrial Labor Relations School of Cornell, on TEMP, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary.
Coming.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the Associate Professor of Economic History at the Industrial Labor Relations School of Cornell University and author of Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. Lewis Hyman, thanks so much for joining us.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start, and I will concede that I had a little bit of difficulty figuring out what should be the first question. But let's start as broadly as we can, insofar as if you could track for us the changes in the way that people perceived the purpose of the economy from, you know, let's say the 30s through to today.
Sure. So that's a really key question. It's something that the book is all about. So basically the book is divided into two parts. There's the first part that's from roughly the 1930s to 1970. That is the story of how different people, corporate leaders, policymakers, labor leaders, tried to create an economy that was stable. You know, they were coming out of depression and war, and of course, 100 years of industrial unrest, and they wanted to figure out how to make industrial capitalism work for everybody. And so the first half of the book is that story, the story, or the first, you know, few chapters is a story of that. And then the second half is, well, what happened? Why does it not work that way anymore? And this is not what our society is organized around. It's around sort of maximizing profit for stake shareholders rather than all the different stakeholders in our economy. And so the story of Temp is the story of how we go from an economy that is based on security and stability to one that's based on insecurity and instability, and the choices that made that happen, so that it pushes back on the story, the narrative we're often told, which is it's just about technology, and it's absolutely not just about technology. It's about the choices we make about how to organize that technology.
Okay, so let's start in that first era when the notion was that the economy should be for the benefit of everybody. But before we go any further, there's a caveat, isn't there? We got to put an asterisk around the word everybody, I guess.
Everybody, yeah. So the you know, when you have to summarize in 30 seconds, that's, you say everybody. But the reality was that security was only defended for white men. And that, you know, everybody who is not a white man had a different relationship to that, right? So white women had access to the security through their husbands, if they were married or not, if they didn't. And then, of course, people of color, people who weren't American citizens, had a very different relationship to that. And that exclusion that I argue that is sort of the people who are left out enables a different kind of economy to be rehearsed in the midst of this prosperity. So a lot of the story is about the 50s and 60s, when you can see in the lives of women temps and Mexican laborers, a world that is going to emerge in the 70s and 80s, but not just for those people on the margins, but for everyone, including white men. And so part of the story is about what happens when you leave some people out of that security and when they don't count as much as white men. And so that's part of the story there as well.
And I have to say, I think that's a super important lesson for folks that can be applied in a lot of different areas, because we're basically talking about folks who were on the margins of political power being the canaries in the coal mine, essentially.
Exactly. And because they were left out, employers were able to use them in ways that undermine security of those white men. So, you know, in the end, the white men, you know, may have had security for a while, whether they were unionists or office workers or executives. But they, in the end, because certain people were not included, then that it was easier for employers to begin to employ undocumented workers in Silicon Valley or lots of temps to replace people. And eventually we get to deindustrialization and downsizing for first the blue collar workers and the white collar workers.
All right. So, I mean, is it enough to for our purposes to say that in that first period that we're talking about in the post-World War period, roughly from 35 to 70, we're looking at, or I guess say 45 to 70, we're looking at stability for white men in the workforce, the ability to make enough to maintain a middle class living. Let's talk about, and if that's not enough, at least to pivot to those who are on the outside, what their job situation was. Tell me, but if it is, let's go through those. I mean, you spoke about women to a certain extent that they have this security as a wife, but talk about the implications of being a person of color, then we'll talk about immigrants.
Sure. I think when we are nostalgic, both on the left and the right, for this post-war period, it's easy to write out parts of that experience as if they can just be sidelined. So this is an era of Jim Crow. This is a moment when African Americans don't have political rights in a lot of ways, and they in very important ways, but in a very everyday kind of way, don't have consumer or labor rights. And, you know, it's a period that we're nostalgic for in this idea that manufacturing jobs were good and office work was good, but it is also a period of, you know, we made that work for us. And, you know, what happens after 1970 is we begin to not make that work. And, you know, I think that as women and African Americans were able to demand better access to, you know, political and economic rights in the 60s and 70s and become to the fore, well, they carry along with them certain kinds of work experiences. And, you know, they're, instead of including them fully into the security of the post-war that white men enjoyed, what we did instead was, not we, but, you know, business owners began to rely on them as cheaper, flexible, more disposable labor. And this is central to the story of the economy in the 70s and 80s, when we begin to move away from automaking as the and aerospace as the big industries towards electronics as the big industry that's driving the economy.
All right. So talk about, I mean, you focus on two companies. I mean, obviously more than that, but two that I think provide that sort of the manpower and the ideology of that transition. Talk about why you focus on manpower and McKinsey consulting.
Sure. So the through line of the book is thinking about these two companies. So the book really looks at how the corporation is remade from top to bottom, how executives get displaced by consultants, how office workers get displaced by temps, how unionized workers get displaced by migrant workers. And an important part of that story is the story of McKinsey and Company, which is the world's most important strategy management consulting firm. It begins in the 1930s as a way to help these new corporations of the 20s and 30s and 40s begin to really modernize. And it becomes a place for ideas about how corporations should organize. And manpower emerges into importance in the same period. Right after World War II in 1947, the founder of Manpower, Elmer Winter, he's a lawyer in Milwaukee, and he begins the very first big temp agency. And, you know, I think that by telling the story through these companies, you see how it isn't a bunch of evil conspiracies. It's about business decisions. It's about business opportunities. But it's also about choices that are being made about different ways to run our businesses. There's always that choice between making life worse for workers and making profits that way, but also opportunities for making things better. And you can see the confusion in the business world over how to run businesses through the stories of these two companies and their centrality in reorganizing the American corporation. So McKinsey and similar kinds of companies like Boston Consulting Group or Price Waterhouse, these are companies that corporations listen to and look to guide them through reorganization after reorganization. And an important pivot in the story is around 1970, when these management consultants, you know, selling big contracts to the country, to the world's largest corporations, begins to encourage them to think about their workforces in a different way, as less about an asset and more as a liability, to think of them more as a variable cost rather than family, and to think of them more as a, something that can be eliminated in the name of prosperity and efficiency. And it's a complicated story, but fundamentally, that's it. Whose ideas matter most in remaking our economy? And I think the answer is the consultants that get paid, you know, an enormous amount of money to remake those companies.
Okay, so what was the dynamic so the change, it seems that when we talk about the change in the economy, right, the perspective of the economy, is that a cultural thing? And if it is, I mean, I'm just curious between the interplay between the broader culture that perceives the economy as a certain thing that changes, right? And the way that McKinsey, for example, changed that made that change that you just talked about. Like, what were the motivating factors? Was it just one day in 1969 somebody said, I want more? I mean, what was it that drove that change?
An important part of this account is something that I think we've forgotten. So most people that remember the 60s today were kids, right? They were having a good time. And there was something that was going on in the 60s that we don't talk about a lot, which is the rise of a new corporate form called the conglomerate. And conglomerates are weird. So it had been the case for most of the history of industrial capitalism that you wanted to be bigger and bigger and bigger, but always within your particular field. So think about U.S. Steel. You know, you want to be big, you want to own steel. Well, conglomerates, these companies were making so much money in the 1960s. Capitalism is working so well, but there were very strong antitrust movements at that point. There were new kinds of financial instruments like the leveraged buyout that allowed companies to take over other companies in unrelated fields. And this happened everywhere in the 1960s. So about 90% of the Fortune 500 became a conglomerate. And what happened around 90, and everybody thought all the business journalists, all the business leaders, all the business schools thought this was made possible by expert managers, that this new kind of manager was able to manage anything. Well, it turned out around 1968, 69, 70, people began to doubt this very intensely because a few of these companies were revealed to have actually produced no additional profit. They had grown their revenues, but they hadn't grown their profits. And suddenly everything began to fall apart in the stock market. But more importantly, it opened up a crisis of how to think about the corporation. And into this crisis stepped a bunch of intellectuals that were business gurus, that were management consultants, that offered an alternative that didn't look like the post-war corporation, but didn't look like the conglomerate either. And basically, they threw out the baby with the bathwater, that this structure that had actually served America very well for many decades was tossed out in the name of progress. And it's true, they were solving for new kinds of shareholder value. It's what historians call the shareholder value revolution, where shareholders really come to the fore. But it's not just that. It's this new way of thinking about the corporation that is so important in this moment. So it's a complicated story, but fundamentally it's about ideas, culture, and not fundamentally about economics.
All right, so
or technology.
We're talking about, so at this point, we're talking about the assets are there insofar as I'm talking about sort of the ideological assets, right? Like we have a class of people who are already functioning as temps, who already do not have job security, whether it's immigrants, people of color, and women who have been left out of that equation, that post-World War equation, by things like Social Security not functioning for specific jobs that are more or less exclusive to people of color and to women.
Domestic and agricultural work. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And what other instruments led to there being this sort of like template for what these financializers who want to get shareholder value? What other dynamics were there? I mean, obviously, if you're an undocumented immigrant, you have no rights, right? What else contributed to their temporary status?
Well, for undocumented migrants, you know, in the early 70s, we see the passage of new kinds of environmental laws like OSHA. OSHA didn't exist until the early 1970s. And, you know, a lot of the industry that was growing at the time, electronics, was dirty industry. And so it wasn't just about labor rights, although it was about labor rights. It was about environmental rights. And so Silicon Valley can grow by giving the dirty, dangerous work to people who aren't part of the polity, who aren't citizens. For temp workers, women in particular, the growth came because Elmer Winter realized by the end of the 1950s that there were only so many secretaries that were going to get sick or go on vacation. And so he began to push for a program of replacing whole workforces with temporary workers that could be brought in as needed. And this didn't work very well. It did until you had the transition to the computer. And in the computer, corporations have this example of the need for huge workforces to do the data entry and turn all that paper into bits. And they start to see this example. And then the crisis happens in 69 and 70. And suddenly, Elmer Winter and Manpower and all the rest of these temp agencies are able to convince corporations to really begin to look to them as an alternative workforce. So in the 1970s, you start to see corporations using huge swaths of temp workers as a buffer against the market, and so that their quote-unquote real employees don't get fired in a downturn. And at the top of this hierarchy are the consultants that are also temps, right? They come in and out of work, they come in and out of workplaces, and they're organized in a very temporary way. They may only work for a few years at McKinsey or BCG. It's a very up or out, very brutal atmosphere, but they also think it's good, and they think this is the right way to organize work. And so consultants use their own model of work to reorganize the corporation. And so all these things kind of come together in the 1970s, in this sort of the global crises of the oil shocks. And, you know, in the moment of crisis, there's opportunity to sell new ideas, to sell new policies. And that's exactly what we see here.
And okay. And so just to disaggregate some of that, the computer allows temp workers to come in, do their work, and it almost creates this sort of short-term institutional memory or long-term institutional memory, right? That wasn't there before, right? You know, Gladys was here yesterday and Mary is here today, and the computer knows where Gladys left off and Mary can just continue with that data entry.
Yeah, so the computer is an important part of this, but the sort of experience for the corporations. And this is an important thing to realize, is that experience matters so much. So no matter how much the data could show a corporate executive, and Elmer Winter had all the data in the world to show that temps were cheaper, that temps were efficient, that temps were a great replacement for your workforce, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it because they didn't want to take the risk. They valued their employees. Well, they have this experience of the, you know, the first data migration, the first time all those spinning magnetic tapes needed to be filled with information of workers coming in, working through the night, doing data entry. And they say, oh, wow. And they do this because they don't want to overtax their existing staff. But they say, oh, wow, look, we can actually replace a whole function in our corporation effectively and efficiently with temporary workers. And it was a good idea. And then it becomes an example for other kinds of activities once the crisis comes in the 70s, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's out there and it's just waiting for its opportunity. And these we have the failure of the conglomerates to bring more profits to shareholders. And then consultants come in and basically, I mean, this is where we move to the financialization of our economy in some respects.
Yes. And in my first two books were about the history of personal debt, which deal a lot with the history of this financialization, deal a lot with the history of how finance became so important, how the 1% in the post-war paid the 99% wages, but after 1970, the 1% just lent them money. And this inequality of work is part of what drives this inequality, the demand for all that debt, the demand for all that consumer debt, the increasing volatility of work, the uncertainty, insecurity of work. And this is the long arc of our society today in terms of finance and work. And these two things are very intertwined.
It's interesting to me because the consultants come in and you draw this parallel between them saying, like, we function as temporary workers. And so this model works. And on some level, it seems like CEOs and board of directors have a similar perspective. I mean, I think this is, you know, they're our audience will recognize this as one of my hobby horses. But the idea of changes in the way that CEOs are compensated through stock options and then the almost the simultaneous tax reform. Or I should say vice versa, the tax reform and then subsequently followed by the change in the way that CEOs are compensated and then their ability to buy back their own stocks. Their thinking, their projections, you know, became less about the long term health of the corporation and more about the short term ability to raise the value of stocks for shareholders, because they had a lot of investment in that company and they can walk away almost with a big payoff from a cottage industry. I mean, isn't that, I mean, part of this dynamic, like these consultants coming in, they're making a lot more than the other temp workers. And
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And the CEOs, they may see it as a temporary position, but they're also making a lot more, in fact, a lot more than they were, you know, relatively speaking, even then. I mean, that seems to be, was it just unfettered greed? I mean, I understand why at that moment, because there was a failure to deliver these increased profits to shareholders. Was that the first time that profits had leveled out? And so that greed was always there. It just wasn't being satiated or what changed?
Well, I like the word unfettered that you just used, because I do think people are essentially greedy and we shouldn't be surprised when they act in their own self-interest. But when we talk about the post-war and how we're nostalgic for it, we often leave out the fact that the top marginal tax rate was 93%, right? So the equivalent today of when that kicked in was about $2 million. So if you made more than $2 million, every dollar after that was taxed 93 cents out of the dollar. And that began to go away. You know, we begin to reduce those top tax rates. And of course, in the Reagan era, we reduced the capital gains rate, which incentivizes the sort of shift from being paid in wages, being paid in stock and the buybacks and all that other stuff. And so I think the rules change, right? So that's part of it, the unfetteredness. And that's an important story to tell as part of this. But it's also important to tell the story of how the corporation itself was shifted away from the long term, like you said, to the short term, not just for the CEOs, but for research, for office workers, for managers. It began to be evaluated on that next quarter or that last quarter, and instead of long-term investment. And they began to prioritize, in the aftermath of this conglomerate failure, rising profits rather than minimizing risk and really technological development. And so there's a lot of ways in which these things all fit together that aren't about finance and about outsized pay for CEOs, which now, you know, I think in the 60s, it was something like 40 times. The average was about 40 times the median worker. Now it's about 400 times the median worker. And, you know, part of that is the way we structure our laws, the fetters. And part of that is also just about, you know, how we think about the purpose of a corporation as a thing that we should extract value from or something that we should invest in for stakeholders like workers and consumers in the long run.
And let me, I mean, I don't want to nitpick, but when we say we, I mean, isn't part of the problem, I think, in terms of why there's such widespread dissatisfaction with the way our economy is working now? And by widespread, I mean, you know, a significant majority of, I think, the population feels frustrated by it.
Yeah.
Some people feel like it's going gangbusters. Is that we as a society have not really considered what the corporations are doing. It's really just the people inside them and who consult with them who have sort of taken over that, you know, like it seems to me that to use that fettering term, that society was much more fettering up until a certain point. And then everything was left to these like businesscrats.
Well, the fetters were made in the 1930s and 40s, right? So we had 100 years where, and just nowadays we're nostalgic for these factory jobs. You hear people talking about how great it is to work in a factory or to work in a coal mine. Well, that was where people went to die. You would lose your arms. You would get black lung. You wouldn't get paid well. We made those jobs pay reasonable for working people. And, you know, today we don't talk about corporations and corporate regulations. We talk about technology. So if you talk to people, they say, well, what's wrong with our society? Well, it's this Uber, it's this app, it's this robot, it's this algorithm. Well, you know, the alternative to Uber is not a good factory job or a stable office job. The alternative to Uber is a part-time job selling coffee or a part-time job working at Walmart. And it's these other corporations that most of us work for that really matter. And then most of us are scrambling to make do with the gig economy to balance that out. And that's the truth of the matter, that Uber is the waste product of the service economy. It wouldn't be possible without the rest of everything going so badly.
Is it also, I mean, and I was going to raise that because you do refer to it as the waste product of the service economy. Is it also a short circuit to any type of reform? I mean, I know it's not designed that way. It's coming in and it's basically cleaning up the dregs on some level and taking advantage of the fact that its drivers are already being taken advantage of by somebody else. But is it also functioning to sort of short circuit maybe any type of larger reforms in that first sector that, you know, of which Uber is a waste product of?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we need to, and when I say we, I mean American citizens. I mean American voters, the American people. And I say we very intentionally because I think it's only by building a majority consensus that we want capitalism to work for us, not for the few. And, you know, capitalism has always been unequal, that it is an engine of inequality, but it's also an engine of growth. And it can be harnessed to create prosperity for all of us. And that's what we have to get back to. Policies on both the left and the right that are dealing with the world as it is and not in this nostalgic way for a world of yesteryear, and engaging with, you know, the new digital economy as it is. And that's going to take not just laws, but workers coming together, trying to create a new kind of voice with each other. And the unions that we have are not doing that. They're just not doing that. And so just in other periods in our history, we need to have new kinds of ways to rebalance power between workers and employers. And, you know, in the end, it can work better for employers as well. You know, the Fortune 100 never failed to make a profit for the entire post-war period. And, you know, we had extraordinary, much faster GDP growth, you know, 9% a year in some periods in the post-war. And, you know, this was amazing. And I think we can do it again. We just have to focus more on how to invest capital that is currently being wasted on speculation and housing markets and whatever into new industries that employ a lot of people, that create jobs. And right now we're not doing that. So you hear a lot in the media about GDP and, you know, unemployment. And certainly the GDP is growing, but for who, right? For whom? So, and unemployment, well, those numbers are low, but so what is left out of that are the number of people between 6% and 8% of the workforce that have dropped out, unable to find work since the last recession. And that's just going to come back to hit us even more so when the next downturn comes.
And you cite in the book, I think 94% of net new jobs over the past something like 15 years or some odd are temp jobs.
That's right. So temp, broadly construed, you know, alternative work, work that doesn't look like you expected when you were a kid, you know, 9-to-5 work. 94% of the one net new jobs, so jobs created over jobs destroyed, are in this space. And so even though the majority of us who have jobs are still in this older workforce model, all the growth is in this new space. And when the next recession comes, and it will happen again, you know, unless there's the end of the business cycle, we will see that the growth and recovery comes in this space. And so now, just like people who were consultants in the 60s, and, you know, Elmer Winter in the 60s, we need to prepare now with new ways of thinking about how we want our economy to be after that next crisis.
So I just want to tie back into that, because where that power comes from. I mean, how much of the demise of unions and really, I guess, like led to the ability of that shift ultimately to a shareholder value economy? And all right, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. So it's easy to think that it was a bunch of laws that were passed in the New Deal that made for a strong labor movement. This is a story we often hear. But in the book, the beginning of the book, I open with the Flint sit-down strike of 1936, where a group of auto workers face down the largest corporation in the world, General Motors, and they win. They sit down, they occupy it, and they don't win because of lawyers. They don't win because of kumbaya. They win because of strategy. They pick a place where if they shut down the body plant for GM, GM has to deal with them. And, you know, this becomes the pattern for all of industrial work in the post-war, the strength of these new industrial unions that didn't exist. The idea you could organize unskilled and semi-skilled workers was an anathema to the American Federation of Labor. And the AFL and the CIO, these industrial unions, they don't actually come back together until 1955. So this is something we forget, and we have to remember that the strongest post-war labor unions came out of breaking away from traditional labor. They occupied a space that was at the time illegal. And I think this is what labor can learn from Uber. Uber is totally illegal. Uber went into every market in America and just violated all the laws. And then somehow they forced them to accommodate it. Well, this is what labor did in the 30s and 40s. And this is what we need to do again. And so when we think about how we've moved from industry to our economy today, the story is about supply chains. It's about warehouses. It's about distribution. And if we look at places where we need to have victories, places like Amazon, well, it's those warehouses that need to be organized, but they need to be organized in relationship to other kinds of distribution, the ports, the truckers, everything. And it's only through that kind of radical activity that we're going to redress the scales. It's not just enough to pass some laws. And part of the failure of unions has been the focus on keeping old jobs rather than understanding new ways that work and business is being organized and maybe putting themselves at risk, just like the founders of the CIO did in the 1930s.
Louis Hyman, author of Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
A real pleasure. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Interesting stuff. Big book.
Super big.
Yeah.
It's some big ones.
It's interesting to hear somebody whose analysis hews so closely to my own, except when you get to the conclusion part.
He's pretty optimistic.
I would say so.
But I think he does recognize that it's going to involve some form of heretofore unseen specific moves by labor that will create this power.
Yeah.
I mean,
I have a lot more thoughts on this, but I'll save them.
We shall see. You should read the book. And
yeah. I mean, he's optimistic in a very different way than I am, I'll just say.
Well, you guys could share your optimism, and I am not so optimistic.
Yeah. He's optimistic about the potential of capitalism to stabilize and create a decent life for everyone, and I'm optimistic about the potential for creating something new.
I am not convinced that maybe some form of capitalism, because I think that he feels that we're going to have to reorient into something different. But I don't know. Maybe that's the sequel interview. Should have him on Antifada and just pick it up from right there.
Maybe I will. Maybe we'll talk about some post-capitalist formations.
Folks, speaking of the
post-capitalist formations,
I was going to say post-capitalist formations, but I guess we're still in the late capitalist formations. This program relies on your support.
Your mom's a formation.
On your support to continue. Oh, wait, we're going to do this. You can go to Join the Majority Report. We still have we have to play this audio for our freebies, just because this is so stunning. But I will remind you, this podcast relies on your support. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. For just a couple of dimes a day, you can support the free programming. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. We're also going to, for members, maybe we'll do this Thursday, provide an interview I did with Juan Cole for Ring of Fire on Yemen, which was pretty interesting, to just sort of get a notion of the mess that place is, that we in our involvement in it. But before we go there, one of the political dynamic around the Kavanaugh thing is pretty fascinating, because I think it has changed, or at least the perceptions of how this is going to shake out politically has changed almost day to day from within the leadership of both parties. I think the conventional wisdom in Washington is that if Kavanaugh is confirmed, it is going to be most damaging politically in the most crass of political terms. From electoral perspective, it's going to be most damaging to the Republicans. And of course, the price that we pay there is that we have potentially another 20 years, 30 years of an onslaught upon established rights for individuals, specifically women in terms of their sovereignty, if established rights for LGBTQ folks, not to mention Brett Kavanaugh's assault on our regulatory scheme, which, you know, barely came up in the context of his hearing because it's what Republicans are going to do. They're going to appoint far-right conservative judges who are going to be activists in their assault on the regulatory functions of our state. Maybe we'll get more into that on Thursday. But one of the other aspects of the political fallout of the Kavanaugh hearings is that Republican candidates have to respond to this. And many of them, and certainly not the majority, but a significant number of them don't have the ability to do so because they are so ignorant as to the idea that women are not chattel, that they can't express themselves in a way that doesn't come off as bat crap crazy. You know, this is, we are in Aiken, Todd Aiken, legitimate rape territory. And along those lines, I give you Representative Kevin Cramer, the U.S. Senate candidate for North Dakota. I mean, this is amazing footage that we're about to play. And this is who Heidi Heitkamp is running against. At the end of it, the most amazing thing about this is that it's still a race after this guy says this. It gives you a sense of just how impenetrable Republican voters are in a state, with all due respect, Matt, like North Dakota. Here is Representative Kevin Cramer. He is on a local channel, one which the host of this channel has already blocked, Matt.
He's very friendly to the Republicans.
So he is on that. Home safe territory.
Block that little luck bastard.
He is being cradled in his mama's arms here. And watch what happens.
I want to play for you a little bit about what was on Meet the Press on Sunday of your radio interview and then give you a chance to respond.
I didn't even know it made Meet the Press.
Here's some of what you said, according to Chuck Todd. Yeah.
These are teenagers who evidently were drunk, according to her own statement, that they were drunk. Nothing evidently happened in it all, even by her own accusation. Again, it was supposedly an attempt or something that never went anywhere.
So at that point, had you seen her actual statement?
Yeah.
Because right. it never says she was drunk in it.
Well, she admits she's a 15-year-old that had been drinking at a party that, I mean, how many 15-year-olds handle a lot of alcohol, you know, 36 years ago, when it wasn't that common, by the way, Chris. 36 years ago, it wasn't that common for 15-year-olds to be at booze parties.
Pause it for one second. Pause it for one second. 36 years ago, I was 15 years old.
Was it common to be at booze parties?
I was 15 years old. And I will tell you.
What was it like back then?
Was
tell
it
us.
Common to be at booze parties?
When you Answer would take the horse the and buggy to the town square and everybody would have hard apple cider. I got news for you. And this guy knows it. Yeah. Girls drank.
Dad said I could borrow the carriage tonight.
Yeah. Girls drank. Boys drank. Everybody drank. Probably a lot more than they drink today, to be honest with you. I think that's probably, there's data to that effect. But continue.
Booze parties. The other thing is, remember, they didn't play the first part of that. The part about the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas.
Correct.
There's no context to there. That's what they do on NBC, by the way, and MSNBC and CNN and all the rest. So, again, this is their way of making sure they're trying to level the playing field.
But to be fair, sure. You said in that quote there, nothing evidently sure. happened in it at all, even by her own accusation. But in her own statement, she says, Kavanaugh was on top of me. He was laughing. He pushed me into the room. She tried to she doesn't say it here, but Kavanaugh's hand was over her mouth. Right. He was trying to undress her. I think most women would say something definitely happened.
Right. That I get. My point was is that there was no type of intercourse or anything like that. That was my point, that nothing happened in terms of a sexual event beyond, obviously, the attack. Now, if it's true, here's the other thing, Chris.
Pause it. I love how he says, beyond, of course, the attack. And like, it just drops, like, the attack. The attempted rape.
Nothing sexual beyond the sex attack.
Right. There was no actual penetration because someone stopped the attempted rape.
Exactly.
So that's what I mean by nothing happened.
Right.
The hand over the mouth, yes.
It didn't go anywhere though after the hand over the mouth.
After put the hand over the mouth, the and he tried to take it. Doesn't count.
But even he realizes, like, how do I get out of this? And he chooses the word attack by just sort of swallowing, like, the attack, and then like. I just
nothing
go back
happened
here.
In terms of a sexual event beyond, obviously, the attack. Now, if it's true, here's the other thing, Chris. We don't know that any of that happened. That's my point. We're trusting one person who doesn't recollect a lot of the facts, but some of them. And we're basing this on the presumption that something happened. We don't know that even what she described happened.
But then, to be fair, why say that when you could have said, look, Judge Kavanaugh's unequivocally denied he was even there, so I'm just going to leave it at that.
Chris, so here's... So let's talk this through a little bit. I do 200 radio shows a year. Heidi Heitkamp talks to her brother occasionally. Do I love to think out loud? Do I love to have direct access to the people of North Dakota? Yes, I do.
Yes, I do. I mean, that's... What's amazing to me, honestly, is that this guy is not announcing, like, I'm going to drop out of the race today because obviously there's no way I can possibly win. Like, the idea that this is still a close race in that state leads me to believe that there is virtually nothing that could happen that would inhibit a Republican from having a viable chance in that state.
Yeah, right.
Regarding his claim that he appears on radio 200 times a year and Heidi only appears with her brother, I think it's true that neither of them really does town halls, but Kramer's 200 appearances are with this guy, Rob Port, who was made a laughingstock in the Washington Post in the first couple of years of Obama because he took a tour and took a picture of, I think, like Marxism in the 19th century or some sort of academic textbook and said the Obamas put it there, but actually it was like... Jackie Kennedy or something.
Communism.
What is absolutely stunning, though, is that the guy is saying, I said these things because I do so many radio shows and so many like that. I like to think out loud. Yet we have just seen him with the perfect opportunity to reinterpret what he said on that radio show and completely say all this stuff again.
Well, I do hundreds of TV appearances.
It's so, not what he said.
It's another appearance.
That is stunning. And
is it though?
Well, sort of. Mm-hmm. I mean, you sort of think that like you'd have the ability. I mean, the guy's running for the Senate and it's close.
We saw that focus group yesterday.
Yeah, but those focus group were other Republican, operatives.
Yo, but also... Like, I feel like you might be able to get the same response from regular Republican women as well. Like, they didn't care about grab them by the pussy. Like, why do we think they're going to care about this?
I don't know.
On the margins, I think some I think some will care. I just don't know if it's going to be enough to keep Heidi in office.
It's stunning. It's stunning.
Think about all the good things we're doing
because
globally.
This guy, you don't even have to believe Kavanaugh is guilty of anything to look at this guy and say there's something wrong with this guy. Right? Like, he's saying that he is completely discounting the idea of an attempted rape, and when he gets called on that, he's like, well, we're not even sure if it happened. But he first says, he dismisses the concept of it.
Yeah, they really need to go with one thing or the other here. You shouldn't be doing that in the same breath.
I wonder about that, though. If there's some, like, short-term tactical, just by having the issue so muddied, them playing defense two areas, it might not be working for them.
I think that's right.
Areas with the doppelganger theory.
Not to mention there was another guy there who had just gotten candied apples from the party, so we're hearing. That looked just like him. It's another guy.
We'll
and
go
being
through.
That as it may, nothing happened, and I'm on TV literally every second of my life, unlike Heidi.
We will go through. That was a weird thing. All Heidi.
She just talks to her brother. Anyways. There was a third member of the room.
All right, we got to take a break. Head to the fun half. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Michael, today is Tuesday.
Indeed.
Which means that you saunter in whatever you feel like it in the morning as a way of prepping for the Michael Brooks show this evening.
Tonight, amongst many other things, but I'll just focus for now on the guests. Alberto Almeida, who is a leading pollster in Brazil, is going to kind of crunch the numbers on that election and talk about whether or not fascism can be stopped at that country. It's looking increasingly likely, and it looks kind of mind-blowing that basically, like, with no access to the press, Lula, and in prison, Lula basically seems like he's orchestrating a win for the Workers' Party. They're surging in the polls. And then Mataibi is going to talk about a new serial he's doing, a book that he's releasing in serial form on sort of an update of manufacturing consent or manufacturing the Noam Chomsky manufacturing dissent.
Consent, you got it.
Yeah, consent, yeah. The Edward Herman book in the 1980s. And we're also going to look at the financial crisis 10 years on.
And Jamie, the Antifada.
Yeah, so we've got an episode coming out this week with our friend Tanzim Ajmeri about a pamphlet she co-authored called How to Overthrow the Illuminati. It's geared towards Black and Hispanic teens who believe in the Illuminati theory as sort of a real attempt to try to figure out why the world is so unequal and unfair. And of course, the pamphlet comes to the conclusion that the real problem is capitalism. So I really like
Spoiler alert.
So the book is an Illuminati plant?
Right. It sounds like an Illuminati book.
I mean, you know, take everything I say with a grain of salt, because in addition to being Jewish, my grandpa played a role in putting fluoride in the water. Fun fact. So
obviously
I probably shouldn't tell people that.
Totally untrustworthy.
Wow. But we have some fun with conspiracy theories. It's all good.
Right. It's interesting to watch Jamie ride her bike and watch the chemtrails come off of the back of it. I will say it's fascinating. It is, you know, the African-American community in particular is, I think, conspiracy theories apparently have some purchase in that community. Largely because of some of the horrible things that have happened to
all the conspiracies.
Because all the conspiracies turn out to be true.
The real conspiracies.
Like, you know that thing where they're giving syphilis to people? Like, I mean.
Right. It's like, yeah. I wonder where AIDS conspiracies came from.
Right. And I mean,
the thing where they killed Fred Hampton.
Matt recently shared a pamphlet with me that has brought me in the opposite direction. I used to think it was capitalism, and now I understand who runs the world.
The Jews.
Yeah.
Matt.
The Jews.
Literary hangover for patrons. I recorded another few chapters last night of Hope Leslie, the audiobook I'm doing and giving away to the public domain. But first, you have to be a patron. I'm really enjoying reading these.
Is that working?
It's working, actually. People are signing up like crazy.
Wow.
Because they want to hear me narrate audiobooks, apparently. And I'm really enjoying it. So even if it doesn't work, I'm still going to continue to read books.
Don't do that, dude.
Get the fuck out of here, loser.
I mean, people should continue signing up because you get a free, well, sort of free audiobooks out of it.
But, yeah,
well, exclusive to my Patreon. No one else, you can't get these audiobooks anywhere else, folks.
Good salesman. Make
all right,
that
folks,
money.
646-257-3920 is the number. Our plan right now is on Thursday. Mike will be here tomorrow. On Thursday, we're probably going to start early. And we may go a little long. We're going to cover the hearings. And if they happen. If they don't, we got a backup plan. So stay tuned. I think they're going to happen. I don't know. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.